Robin Hanson is an economist at George Mason University and the author of The Elephant in the Brain. This is Robin Hanson. I'm Duncan Gamby. You're listening to Dunk Tank.
Great. I'm here with Robin Hanson. Thank you for joining me.
Hello, Duncan.
So there are a number, you have a great blog, a great Substack, Overcoming Bias, and people should go check it out. And you have opinions on a lot of different things. And I wanted to ask your opinions during this conversation on a few different subject matters. But one of the things that came up recently in the news is that the New York Times is suing OpenAI over copyright infringement. And their argument is, you know, hey, given these prompts, you can very easily reproduce New York Times articles. And this feels like the sort of the thin end of a wedge against, these amazing models that have developed or come into, public view over the past year or two. Do you have any strong opinions, first off, on how you feel like this should play out? In other words, where ideologically would you want to see the court make a decision on this?
My first preference would be to try to fit AI into existing human slots. That is, we worked out a lot of law over a long time for how humans should interact with each other. And we have these new creatures, AIs, in the world. And if we can treat them like humans, we should, in the sense that we've worked out all these, details about how to handle conflicts of interactions. Now, there may well be ways in which AIs are different from humans, big enough that we should adjust our interaction mechanisms and generalize it. But in some sense, we've done that in the past. That is, maybe we initially had law for everybody in the same village, and then we had to generalize law for what happens if it's travelers and foreigners and what happens, et cetera. And of course, we generalized law as, say, the Industrial Revolution appeared and technology changed. And once we had laws for when horses collided, and then we, added cars. But for the most part, law, we've done a pretty good job taking the general principles of law and adjusting them slightly or modestly to accommodate the changes. So that would be my first priority. I'd say, can't the usual law for humans work? So the usual law for humans here is, when you read something that you're allowed to read, you're allowed to learn from it.
Right.
And you're allowed to embody what you say to other people with that knowledge that you've learned from what you've read, unless you have some particular non-disclosure agreement where you agree not to disclose what you've learned. Now, that doesn't mean you're allowed to just resell copyrighted works. Say, I'm allowed to read a novel, but I'm not allowed to give the exact same words of that novel to someone else, at least. Actually, I mean, it's less clear how that worked, but, so libraries, of course, buy a book and then rent, let lots of people read it. You might have thought the book authors, the book sellers wouldn't have wanted to allow that. And apparently some quirk of law prevented the booksellers from preventing libraries from redistributing their books. But, there's quirks like that. But basically, we've, limited maybe exact redistribution of things. Let's say patents are a concept. You're not allowed to reuse the patent, even if you can't resell the patent to someone, even though you can use the patent if you pay a licensing fee. So we do make some distinctions at points about when you're allowed to use what you know, but maybe not tell other people. But mostly, you're allowed to incorporate what you learn from what you see and then use that in other things you do. So that's what I would hope we could do for AI too. And it's not obvious to me we couldn't do that. And it seems like this is mainly motivated by trying to restrict it. But of course, these large language models are to some degree going a little too far and just spitting things back. In which case, you'd want to say, well, you're allowed to maybe paraphrase what you learned and use it in things, but just directly. So, we have norms when students write essays, say, I'm a teacher. Yep. They're certainly allowed to summarize things they've learned from what they've read and incorporate in their arguments, but they're not supposed to just directly copy what they read, right?
Right. And you mentioned the case of libraries, and you're probably familiar with, I think it's called like the Internet Library or the Online Archive or something like that, where they're basically just an online library where for every digital copy of a book that they quote unquote lend out, they have a physical copy on hand. So in theory, this shouldn't be a problem, but publishers are suing them and trying to make it impossible for them to function, which just feels so ridiculous. So it feels like the bias on behalf of publishers and maybe just creators in general is against something like ChatGPT or any of these other LLMs. When you said they're going too far, do you feel though that much of what is motivating sort of the animus towards AI right now is people feeling like, oh my God, this technology is going to replace me, or it sort of degrades my sense of romance about human ability to see a machine do something better than a trained professional could do. Even if all the copyright issues were resolved, if the technology still was able to do what it's doing today, I mean, don't you think people would still be kind of, a certain segment of people would be despairing over this?
Well, I certainly think a distinctive thing that happened in the last 2 years is that we had some achievements and systems which really impressed on a lot of people that this had made a big leap, and they could see in these results, imagining a system eventually that would be very human-like. That is, when they talk to a large language model, it looks impressively like a human.
Yeah.
And so that lets them imagine, well, what will happen when these things are generally capable, and they can be scared or concerned or whatever they have about that. But I think, up until recently, the progress wasn't so vividly of that form where they could just more easily imagine the complete. Now, I still think we're a long way off. We're still many decades away from full human level AI, but at times we have advances that just make people able to imagine that. So there's an old saying, don't confuse a clear view with a long distance, but we often do.
Yeah.
It's often when we have a clear view that we get focused on something, even if it's far away, and talk a lot about it and think about what to do.
Interesting. So, and I want to take what you said, this human level AI, and it feels slightly adjacent to this term that's being thrown around, AGI, artificial general intelligence. And I want to, at some point, talk about sort of the scholarship standards of the social sciences, which has come into play in the news recently with, these sort of Harvard scandals, et cetera. But these terms, they feel more like they feel much weaker than what we would see within the hard sciences or like computer science. In other words, one person's AGI is not another person's AGI necessarily. When someone says human level AI, it's like, well, a lot of these tools are human level or better for many tasks that humans do. So are we trying to replicate everything that a human mind can do? Is that our standard for saying that this is now human level? Or am I wrong for saying that these terms are overly ambiguous and potentially just part of like a hype cycle?
Well, standard economics would talk about particular jobs being bundles of tasks and talking about the degree to which any particular set of machines could do those particular tasks. And economists wouldn't traditionally talk at all about AI in general or AGI in general. We would then just talk about which tasks are being, automated at what rate, what happens when a task gets highly automated, how do you change the bundles of tasks that go into a job, what happens to the job in terms of wages or a number of workers. That's how economists would talk about these things. And then in those terms, the question is just, well, what's the rate at which job tasks are being automated? And, how does that affect wages and employment and growth rates? And that literature has been around for a long time, and it tends to assume a relatively steady world where we slowly make improvements on automation of tasks, but then the people who are relieved from more responsibilities on a task switch to other tasks, and then new tasks are introduced that people had never did before, and the economy just grows on from there. It's computer scientists and other people who are pushing this idea that there will be a time in the foreseeable future when many, even most tasks on jobs will all be automated, all at the same time, all to a large degree, all relatively quickly. Yeah. There's not much economics precedent for that scenario at all. And many economists like me push back and say, where did this come from? And still people say, hey, you should consider it. It's not a zero chance. And you'd be irresponsible if you didn't consider my favorite scenario, which is a whole, all of a sudden, lots of jobs get automated. Lots of job tasks get automated very quickly in a short time. Then what? And so the conversation is not being forced by social scientists here. It's being forced by the public and many computer scientists who are pushing this scenario.
That's true. And the sort of the response that they typically give when you say something like, oh, there's no economics precedent for that, is they say that, oh, we're on an exponential curve and, you know, we're here. And so, you know, things look like, you know, it's all stable, but actually we're just rocketing to the moon. And, you know, how can we not see that this is coming?
Well, I mean, we've been on an exponential trend for a century or two.
Yeah.
So the status quo is already the result of this exponential trend. But maybe what they mean is there'll be a new exponential trend with a fractional exponential that will appear sometime in the near future, which hasn't appeared yet. And then they want us to engage that postulated different exponential scenario.
Yes, or they may say like, oh, we're just on the very beginning of this exponential trend, and that it's going to
But it's a new trend that
is,
at the moment, is negligible. That is, the effects of that trend on the world today are negligible and have been for a long time, but eventually that new trend will matter a lot.
And what is your sort of main argument against the idea that this is coming anytime in the near future? Do you just reject sort of the time horizon that these people give, or do you think this is not going to happen whatsoever?
So first of all, you know, the most conservative thing is to project that the future is like the past.
Sure.
The automation will continue as it has. And I've done, you know, work theoretically and empirically on automation in the past, and we could talk about it if you like. Yeah. And so far, automation hasn't been an issue. Now, there's a sense in which even the past continuation could go to a place where eventually machines do most jobs, but that would be a slow, continuous process, and we can project what it would look like. So we can take seriously the idea that eventually machines take all the jobs at a very slow pace, such that people could slowly adapt. And then we could say, well, that happened slow enough that, you know, we can guess roughly what it's like now, but we also don't have to guess that much. We can just wait and adapt when it gets here. You know, then what people are going to postulate is that there will be a different scenario, different than what we've seen so far, but something they think is logically possible or even plausible given their technological hypotheses. And so then the question is to anticipate that. Now, I mean, I do think it's quite possible to imagine a point in time where there's a acceleration in the rate at which automation happens.
Yeah.
Like maybe even over a 5 or 10 year period that you have an enormous change. And even that, like, we can understand in ordinary econ terms and analyze. And the default would be that this happens sort of as a worldwide thing, like the whole world together gets better and produces more automation, et cetera. And then I've discussed, like, the most straightforward thing to do about that is to make sure people have insurance against that sort of an event. There's straightforward ways to do that, and that would be the best response. And then if people had insurance, then there isn't that much to worry about, in the sense that we can wait and adapt to it as it occurs, as long as people are insured against that risk. But then other people go further and they say, no, it's not just that I'm postulating a much faster rate of automation at some point in the future. They also want to postulate that it's concentrated in a small number of systems or companies who encompass most of the change of that short period. And then they want us to think about that scenario. And then they want us further to think about the scenario where that happens, you know, a small concentrated system has most of the advances over a short period, and that the company, you know, managing that gets it out of control, loses control of it. Somehow, even though they're encompassing like most of the wealth of the world and this great thing they're doing that, you know, is projecting the whole world for us, somehow they're just not paying attention and something goes terribly wrong in their ability to monitor and manage this, you know, genie they've got. So right. That's a further scenario that people want us to engage. And so the point here is there's a whole bunch of assumptions you have to make step by step to get further and more extreme scenarios. And so which of these scenarios you want to discuss is up to you. But the point is to notice how many assumptions you have to make before you get to the extreme scenarios.
I think that's a good point. Have you ever played Chinese checkers before?
Sure.
Okay. For people who don't know, it's just like an abstract strategy game, board game, star-shaped board. You have marbles in like one sort of triangular corner. You're trying to get them to the other side. You can only hop one marble at a time, one space at a time, or you can hop as many marbles as you want, as long as they're in the same line as your marble. I played that recently with some friends, and I lost, but I tried every time it came to my turn, I tried to like predict, you know, like, oh, if I do this, what, trying to look like 20 moves ahead. And especially once all those marbles get in the middle of the board, things are just so complex that you can't see ahead, and you kind of just have to rely on some like basic heuristics. And maybe, as you said, insurance, you know, certain things you don't want to do, because you just can't see past this complexity. And part of the reason I bring this up is I feel like it can lead into sort of other topics as well. Like, you know, we talked last time a little bit about gene editing, and I'm curious if this may not be some sort of like variant of Chinese checkers, where if we're trying to say, oh, we want to make like a smarter population, and we're going to edit genes in this particular way, there may just be too much complexity in terms of, you know, the sort of interactions of different genes when we change them, as well as like the downstream effects on the population when this new designer baby, this fleet of designer babies gets thrown out into the world.
I just lost you for a minute there. So,
okay.
We're a long pause, and that may be a minute. So,
Okay. I was just saying, I wonder if Chinese, or I wonder if gene editing is potentially some sort of like variant of Chinese checkers, where the editing that we make to particular genes, we may not be able to see, you know, let's say what we're trying to do is get a smarter population. We edit certain gene. Did I cut out from you again?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Let me turn off some other devices. Sorry about that. Okay. Hopefully that doesn't cut out again. I can start back where I was just saying, maybe gene editing is like some version of this, where there's just so much complexity, the even minimal edits may have consequences that we don't foresee, and that for this reason, perhaps any sort of gene editing is just a bad idea. Do you buy into that at all?
The more general issue here is planning versus adaptation.
Yeah.
Just in general, the world's complicated. And one simple strategy in the world is just to wait till things happen and respond to them. Don't make plans at all.
Yeah.
Another strategy is to try to make complicated plans into the future and expect that they'll work. And the usual intermediate strategy is to make plans, but don't believe them.
Yeah.
That is to let the plans orient your thinking and help you be ready to adapt to the right sort of things at the right time, but don't really believe your plans, and mostly rely on, you know, short-term plans and a lot of adaptation.
Yeah.
I think that is roughly the right way to do most things. Now, for things that people are afraid of, they often think that's insufficient. If they can imagine a problem several steps ahead, they want you to guarantee to some degree that that won't happen. And that's really hard in a world of a lot of complexity. So you might tell them, well, yes, we know that's going to happen, and we're going to be watching for it, but we really can't plan to not make it happen because that's too complicated. We're just going to know to watch out for it. And when it gets close, we'll deal with it then.
Yeah.
And people are often just not willing to let that happen. They want a plan, and they want you to assure them that the plan will guarantee that this problem won't happen. And that often comes at great expense.
Yes.
It often means that you're just going to shut down a lot of things, because people will say, look, if you go down that path, you might reach the problem. We can't allow that. So we just can't allow you to go down any of the paths that might reach the problem, in which case you're just going to cut off a whole range of possibilities.
Right.
Overregulate, basically. So I think that's true in AI or gene editing. The fact that you can imagine something going wrong shouldn't be enough to say, no, nobody can try this. But it might be enough, say, to introduce some degree of liability. Well, we say, well, let's make sure that whoever is taking these chances has good incentives. If things go wrong, they pay. Somebody yes. pays on their behalf because we want to make sure that people don't too easily go down a path and take too large a risk that they can't cover. So the extent you could cause a problem that you can't fix, you can't cover, the more we might say, okay, you can't do this unless you're covered. Like you get enough insurance, somebody else to cover your risk such that if something goes wrong, they'll pay. And now we might think the two of you together will watch out for the problems. So that's a much more robust solution than just trying to guarantee that bad things never happen.
I think that's true, but I also think there are some scenarios where you almost can't impose like meaningful penalties because the sort of, I'll give an example. In international relations, something that a president might do the effects of it may only be truly realized well past the time when they're out of office, so they can't run for re-election. Something like we see in international relations where right now a lot of people want to fund, Ukraine's efforts against Russia with the idea that, oh, if we don't do this, then China will be emboldened and they'll feel more willing to attack Taiwan. And this is like the sort of bank shot that people like to make, where like we made it with like Vietnam, this sort of domino theory. And yet now Vietnam is a much better friend of ours. They're afraid of China. That wouldn't have been predicted by this domino theory that would say that communist countries should be aligned. But the people who planned and executed the Vietnam War, with like some exceptions, LBJ, largely those people, I don't think that, like, Kissinger was a pretty popular guy even after he left. He had people who hated him, but he was still on the world stage making moves. I don't think that necessarily people like on the side of Ukraine now are going to face meaningful penalties politically. And I think it's just hard to impose those. And so it may just be the case that people should say in the realm of international relations, like, we're not going to try to do these sort of bank shots at all. And that should be the break that's imposed on people. Is that too much, do you think?
Well, if you were talking about small actors making choices, you would talk about maybe wanting government regulation, and I might say liability would go better. If you're trying to talk about how we hold presidents accountable,
yeah,
I might say we have very limited options there. If you want to create some foreign policy regulatory body that protects us from the president, we're going to say, well, who did we put in charge of that exactly, and how do they get elected, right? In some sense, the way we set it up is the president is our last defense against all the other people. And you say, who protects us from the president? Nobody.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the nature of democracy, really. You can have norms in the public that the public sees certain sort of actions as intrinsically dangerous and that, they're going to hold it against a president unless they can prove otherwise. But that's about sort of public expectations. I certainly think we might have that expectation about, say, initiating a war.
Yeah.
And I think that's common, right? If our leaders were to initiate a war without much precedent, they were just to say, this looks like a good opportunity. Looks like they're weak and we're strong and we could just take them.
Yeah.
I think most people would find, that's pretty risky. Things could go really wrong there and disapprove, which is why they'd go out of their way to make up a pretext where they started it and we're just reacting. But that's examples of norms that the public has about what they're suspicious of. So you could try to convince the public of your bank shot norm, and right. Maybe you could, but it sounds more complicated. I mean, I don't quite understand it yet, so you haven't even convinced me. And once you convince me, it'll be still much harder to convince everybody else. But that is the nature of democracy at the largest scale. The public doesn't understand very much. They can't remember very much. They can't be taught very many complicated rules. And they're in charge of overseeing these actors who then could have bad incentives. And that's just the nature of the system.
I think that's a fair response. And I don't necessarily think that presidents should never try to do either bank shot or, you know, multi-stage plans. Definitely don't think that. But I do think that they should be more skeptical of their reasoning when those sort of plans have seemed to have gone awry in the past. And one thing that I guess I wanted to ask you, particularly in your role as an economist, one thing that Schwarzenegger, when he was governor of California, after he left, he said that he became governor because the economy was doing bad. And he admitted after he left, he's like, really, it wasn't the previous governor's fault. He's like, it's nobody's fault when the economy goes bad. Is there like a way that we can assign blame for when things go bad in the economy? Or is that just a fruitless task?
Well, it's a hard task. So there's a difference in voting theory between what's called prospective and retrospective voting. So prospective voting is where you evaluate the people who are running and their intended policies, and you evaluate what you expect those policies to produce and what consequences you like or don't, and then you add it up to decide to elect whoever has the better package of prospective policies that you expect to do well. Retrospective voting is where you look on the past and see what the incumbent and incumbents have done, and you try to evaluate those performances and judge them to be better or not than some trigger threshold, and reject them if they have done a poor performance and retain them if they've had a good performance. Retrospective voting, at least in the simplest form, just demands far less of voters. Voters don't need to know very much. And in fact, the extreme version of retrospective voting is where each voter just looks at their own personal life. That all they have to do is say, is your life better or worse than you expected it to be when the incumbent took office? And if it's worse, you reject them. And if it's better, you reinstate them. And if everybody does this, then that creates pretty good incentives for the incumbent.
Right.
Now, this doesn't distinguish things they had control over or not control over, but from their point of view, they're still going to do the best they can. And sometimes they'll be kicked out of office for things that weren't their fault. But hey, overall, it's still a pretty good system.
Right.
And it demands very little of voters. However, of course, voters try to do more than this. And in some sense, that's good that they're maybe trying to figure out what the people are responsible for, not and only blame them for the things they're responsible for. But there's a sense in which doing better does worse, because voters overestimate what they understand and what they can figure out about the policies and their consequences and who's responsible. And that allows politicians and other people to play lots of games with lying and misleading people about what policies have what consequences and who caused what, et cetera. And there'd be a lot to be said for just keeping everybody at the very simple retrospective position of just look at your own life and ask if it's gone better than you expected. And, you know, vote them in if yes and out if no. So we could go, if you liked, into the details of what goes wrong as people try to become better informed. But that's basically a key trade-off here is how ambitious should voters try to be to move beyond simple retrospective voting?
I would like to talk a little bit more about that, because that's the writer Nassim Taleb said that when he was a trader, he wouldn't read the newspaper at all because he didn't want to be like fooled by randomness and all this noise and stuff like that.
Right.
And so when you talk about what goes wrong as people become better informed, is that sort of what you're talking about?
Let's assume rational voters,
right?
Not a crate. There's things that goes wrong even for them. So first of all, as a politician, say you've got a budget of benefits to hand out and you're trying to think about who to slant them toward. Now, under the simple retrospective voting thing, everybody who has a vote, you count equally. So for example, if they're poor and it's cheaper to give them benefits and make them happy, you do that because, hey, it's cheaper to buy a poor person's vote than a rich person's vote by giving them benefits, right?
Right, sure.
So, that would have a, bias toward redistribution, which most people don't think is a terrible thing. But if somebody could actually be better informed than another voter to know when benefits were targeting them and to be aware of that and to know who is responsible and to reward the politician who's responsible. When the voter knows that fact about a voter, well, they're naturally going to slant more benefits in their direction. So now voters are in a competition to know more and prove to the candidates that they know more in order to get benefits slanted their way. So now we've got a competition that some people do win. In fact, some people are just much better able to figure out whether the benefits are coming their way and who caused it and whether they like it than others. And so those people just were going to get a lot more benefits. And that is a thing we see, of course, in politics, that the more informed classes, like, for example, civil servants, if you know you're getting your job from the government, yeah, and they might cut your job or not cut your job, you know, hey, they didn't cut your job, they expanded your kind of job. Well, you know, hey, to reward them for that, and you're very well aware of that. And so civil servants would have outsized power and influence because politicians would know very well that they're going to be fully aware of the consequences of their choices for those people, right? So that's one thing that goes wrong. It's just we end up with this competition to be more informed, which is basically a way of rent seeking, we call it, to take benefits from some people and give them to others by the competition to prove to politicians that you're watching them, and if they don't treat you right, you're gonna not, you know, not reward them, and some of you are just much better able to do that than others. So that's one thing that goes wrong. A second thing goes wrong is part of this calculation a candidate's going to do in asking whether they should send benefits your way is to ask, what's your chance of being pivotal in the election? What's the chance that your vote will switch them from winning to losing?
Right.
And it turns out that the chance that you'll be pivotal goes up if you and another group of voters vote together as a block.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a strategy you and a group of people want to do. You want to get together and agree to vote together as a block. You either all vote yes or all vote to go no, all together as one unit. Now, how do you internally decide whether you vote yes or no? Well, you could do one of these retrospective voting things where the group of you goes, for us group as a whole, you know, are we better or worse off? And then we'll vote yes if the group as a whole is better off and no if not. And at the individual level, what this looks like is group-oriented altruism. Instead of voting on your personal experience, now you're looking at the group you're in and asking how well we did. And
right.
That's something we tend to praise, an altruistic, generous person who cares about other people. But here you see it's really a strategic way in which a group of people can get more benefits relative to other groups. If your group can coordinate to vote together as a block and other people can't coordinate to do that, then politicians know to send votes your way. Sorry, to send benefits your way,
yeah,
because you matter more. So that's another thing that happens here as we move away from simple retrospective voting. First is people get a competition to be better informed. And the second is a competition to form blocks that you vote together as blocks. The bigger the block, the bigger this effect. And that creates an incentive to form very big blocks who vote altruistically, i.e. vote on what's good for the group as a whole, as opposed to them individually.
Do you think that's also why, because when you were talking about forming these voting blocks, my first sort of thing I'm thinking of is like, okay, well, what if you're a member of two blocks that are contradict or that have opposing interests? And, you know, we talk about the rise.
You're in somebody else's block. You're not in our block. I mean, the whole point is our block has to coordinate on us voting together. If you vote based on some other block, you're not voting based on our block. You're not really in our block. So,
It's true, but it's like, okay, what if you're, this is completely hypothetical, but what if you're like a black woman in Pennsylvania who's a coal miner? And it's like, okay, you're on the one hand, you're a group of Pennsylvania coal miners that, you know, that seems like a Republican, you know, would drill baby drill type voting block. But then on the other, it's like, okay, black woman tends to go Democrat.
Right. I mean, the simple thing is the groups force you to choose which group you're in.
Right.
And then the next thing that happens is these groups merge together to form larger groups.
Right.
And they get even more benefit from their size of their block by being a larger group. So, and these are things that do happen a lot in politics. Small groups try to merge together into large groups that vote together as a group.
Is this something people say that we're more polarized now? I don't, and that's apparently true from some studies, but I don't have a long enough, I haven't been alive long enough to know if that's true. And you do see signs that say, you know, like the, just if you believe one thing, like, okay, in this house, we believe love means love and no human is elite. And it's like, you know, as soon as you know what a person believes, what if they believe one of these things on that sign, then we know they believe all of these things. Is that a new phenomenon? Where does that come from?
That's a phenomenon that varies across history. At the moment, the U.S. is near an extreme of this phenomena. That is, other countries in the world aren't as polarized as we were. We're more polarized than we used to be. There were times in the past where we were similarly polarized, say before World War I. And so plausibly, this will go down again in the future. The question is, what will cause that? But we are at an... But polarization is usually about sort of, you know, party affiliation here. It's about some group affiliation. It doesn't mean that we are that much more similar in our specific policy opinions. It means that we're more trying to be voting as a group. And we are forming these larger groups that we're more attached to and more willing to vote along the group and to punish people socially who aren't in our group in other ways in the rest of our lives.
Yeah, for sure. There's a question. This is completely unrelated to voting and things like that. But I wanted to ask you about medicine, healthcare. I know this is something you've written about before. And I had my own sort of experience this year where I had scabies for almost a year. And these dermatologists were like, oh, it's eczema, or like, oh, you have some immune disorder, whatever. They gave me all this crazy medicine that did not help, made things worse. But I did my own sort of like, just sort of check of the probability, after I got a proper diagnosis, cause they did like a skin thing or whatever. And based on like, you know, the different sort of things they diagnosed me with and like their incidence in the population, along with the fact of like, you know, I wasn't responding to medicine that was supposed to treat these things. Basically, like from a statistical standpoint, it should have been obvious that this was like scabies. And I'm curious if there's been any sort of like larger studies about that, where they did sort of an approach like that, like, okay, statistically, what is this person most likely to have? Versus what is the doctor's diagnosis, and sort of compared the success rate of these diagnoses, and whether or not that sort of study has taken place. Why don't doctors just do this more often? It seems like a lot of the times they're just, I don't know.
So in 1984, which is a long time ago, almost 40 years ago now, I left grad school to go off to Silicon Valley, where at the time there was an AI boom. And part of that AI boom was that articles were appearing in the top medical journals describing how AI systems could diagnose many things as well as doctors of the time. That was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
People, of course, tried to field these systems to get people to use them. And the main obstacle was just medical licensing says the only people allowed to use these AI systems are doctors themselves.
Oh.
And sometimes doctors do today use some system, but it takes longer than just listening and having their first reaction that pops into their head because they have to type things in, et cetera. And so that's basically AI and other statistical approaches probably could give, you know, equivalent or even superior diagnoses at all times in this last 40-year period, except they're not allowed to.
Yeah.
And that's going to continue for a long time.
Would you lobby to change those rules?
Well, sure. But I'm just the usual economist would say, hey, allow a lot more competition here. But most people are very risk averse and scared about medicine. And so they support doctors being fully in charge and doing whatever they want. And they say, we got to trust the doctors. They're the best people and we're scared here. So let's put them in charge and do what they say. And what they say is, hey, you can't go to anybody else but us. We're the only people in charge available. You can't make things that compete with us. That's not allowed. And so these statistical tools would compete with them.
How do you feel about this like healthcare skepticism wave that has sort of like swept people, where I'm certainly not like an RFK Jr. type anti-vax or whatever, but I can see where those people are coming from, particularly after this experience where the so-called experts were like quite literally the ones peddling pseudoscience to me.
Sure. But I mean, it is true that initially, if you just open the gates and let anybody use anybody for medicine,
Yeah.
Initially, they're going to use a lot of quacks, and a lot of people will get hurt by overconfident evidence. I mean, what, you know, support. So I might point to how that'll play out if we let it adjust over time and let people learn to get skeptical and let new institutions show up. But no. I think you got to admit that right out of the gate.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all these customers are now who are trusting these doctors, they're going to start trusting a bunch of other people, and that's not going to go well initially. Right.
Definitely. Yeah. And what, one of the things that one of my coworkers from the Czech Republic gets, he was comparing going to like a private healthcare versus like whatever the government funded. And he said the private healthcare, in his opinion, is more quick to sort of push, you know, medicine, pills, prescriptions, et cetera, instead of whatever lifestyle interventions, because, you know, they can charge it, right, whatever, to insurance. Is that largely true?
The basic fact here, the general fact of interest, is that there's a number of products like medicine, law, et cetera, where ordinary people are trying to buy something from experts.
Yeah.
And the mechanisms they use to buy it aren't giving those experts very good incentives. They just are at risk of the experts being self-serving in ways that don't hurt the help the clients. That's just a basic fact about a lot of industries in our world today.
Yeah.
So one of the ways that we fix that problem is that we regulate an industry like medicine, and we say, oh, well, these experts are in charge of that, and nobody can do anything they don't approve. And then they only approve certain things, and then we all feel, the problem solved.
Yeah.
And even in some sense, even if it isn't, people feel okay with that. That's, in some sense, the most common solution. Obviously, another solution might be to just let everyone go wild and then hope or expect that over time the market will sort it out, and people will figure out who's better. But hey, that might take a long time.
Yeah.
As an economist, I've specialized in trying to think about how exactly we could buy these things in a way that doesn't put us so much at risk for not knowing what the hell we're doing.
Yeah.
And I have come up with some mechanisms. So for medicine, my recommendation would be to merge health and life insurance so that whoever is supposed to give you your medical care is at risk if bad things happen to you, bad things happen to them.
Oh, well, why would bad things happen to them in this case with merging them?
Well, because if you die, which is bad for you, they have to pay life insurance out, which is
the
bad for them.
Do. Okay, yeah.
We are merging the organization, right? The organization that provides you health insurance also provides you life insurance.
Right, yeah.
We could add disability insurance and pain insurance, and we can crank up the amounts. And so now they more feel your pain. That is...
Yeah, why are they doing that? That's so obvious.
Right, well, I mean, this is a very heavily regulated industry. And so at the moment, medicine and insurance are both regulated.
Yeah.
So that's an obstacle. But in addition, customers don't feel as skeptical as they should, I might say. You talked about the increased in skepticism, but what I mostly see from a distance is a lack of skepticism. I see people just trusting in a way that they don't feel they need these more distrusting mechanisms. So I might try, like even for voting, I might say, look, you're trusting your politicians way too much. And I could find you some better mechanisms, but people aren't going to be interested in them until they realize they are trusting these people too much. You're trusting your lawyer too much, your doctor too much, you're trusting teachers too much. You're trusting all sorts of people too much, because this is just a very common human strategy. Especially, you know, we tend to use prestige as a solution to trust problems. We say, okay, I'm at risk with this doctor. What if I can't trust them? What if they're, you know, just going to line their pockets and not help me? What do I do about this fact that I'm at risk for them? Because they know things I don't, and how am I supposed to judge them? And people say, oh, well, if they're prestigious, that's always a problem. What? Yeah, if they went to a top school and they're making a lot of money, they're going to be a very prestigious person. Those people wouldn't cheat me, right? Prestigious people wouldn't cheat me. So, and we do that for politicians. The politicians, they went to a top school and they're handsome and they wear a nice suit and they're articulate. So they wouldn't cheat me because they're prestigious people. And we use this solution all through our world. We use prestige as a solution to trust problems in a way that I might say, you know what? Just because a lawyer's went to a top school and has paid a lot of money doesn't mean they won't cheat you.
Right. It is in another one of these things, though, that in the face of like overwhelming complexity, which it feels so much even more obscure when we get into like these like expertise fields of law or medicine, that it's like, okay, well, maybe prestige is like a good heuristic, and I'm not sure what a better heuristic would be.
Well, so for example, I've often talked about using betting markets for many sorts of things. And so when somebody makes a claim, let's see what a betting market says. And many people don't want to use that or even allow it to be legal.
Yeah.
And there's many other ways in which, say, you get advice. So, for example, one of the key things you get advice in your life about is your career. Where should you go to school? What job should you take, et cetera? And I think people don't get good advice about that.
No.
And I'd like to create what I call a tax career agent, somebody who, when you pay money to the government in taxes every year, that money goes to them. And they pay up front for that, the right to get that money. And now, well, they want you to have a better job.
Right.
They want you to have a more lucrative career because now they'll get more money. And I want to make it possible for you to create a tax career agent who has your interest at heart such that you can get more better advice. And many people, they don't want this one to, not only they don't want such an, they don't want anybody to be allowed to have them. And same for betting markets. People don't want to have betting markets on things the government claims. So for example, you know, a government, say NASA could say that their next telescope will cost $3 billion and we could just trust them, or we could have a betting market that says, how much will it be really? And that, right, I would argue, could give us a better estimate of how much the project will really cost. And people don't want that to be legal. They do not want to allow betting markets that would question the judgment of NASA. They just want to have prestigious people in charge of NASA and for us to trust them.
Could I ask sort of a larger question here? Because when we're talking about like, oh, people don't want these things to happen, it's like, when you walk through the reasoning of why a betting market is a good idea, it makes total sense. And there's sort of like, I don't know, maybe like a weirdness factor here where like, if, you know, most people, when they hear that, they're just like, that seems weird, and kind of like move on. And like,
I think it's more than just weird. If it were just weird, we could overcome that.
Okay.
I think it's more that there's distrust involved and money involved.
Sure.
So, you know, if we talk about the NASA budget thing, right? We might say the NASA administrator, you know, they're, you know, they might lie about the budget of the project, but they're a prestigious person. Prestigious people wouldn't do that. We might think, well, look, they really have an incentive to lie because they get their project approved more easily if they lie about the budget.
Yeah.
We might think, yeah, that happens sometimes, but not with this guy. I look at his face and I trust him. And we say, well, let's set up a betting market where people let it. And you say, those people are trying to make money. That they could lie all over the place. We don't want that going on because those people would be lying because the money is involved. So we just have this reaction. If people are profit-oriented in some context, we say, can't allow that. And that would be true for, so even this merging health and life insurance. You might say, oh, well, this insurance company now will get, you know, merged in with the doctors. Somebody in the administration of the insurance company will be telling the doctors, hey, do this, don't do that. And we say, but those insurance company people, they're motivated by money, and that's bad. The doctors are motivated by their pledge to take care of life and their deep love of humanity, because that's what doctors are, right?
Right. Yeah. I hear what you're saying, and I think you're right. I think, though, that there is still something where it's like, even having an interest in these kinds of ideas, the kinds of, I think, is selecting for a crowd that is largely considered, I'm conscious of the fact, I don't want to set it up and be like, oh, like the cool, smart people who are interested in betting markets, and all the normies who aren't are just,
right.
But at the same time, I do think that there's like, maybe you don't have to call it like a weirdness factor, but like, some sort of,
I mean,
there's
a weirdness factor, but it's interacting with something else important. So think about the rest of society when we don't do or don't like change and how we feel about change, right?
Yeah.
So there's large segments of society where Of course, we get comfortable and familiar with existing things, but when people tell us there's a new thing we might try that might be better, we're often pretty interested in trying that. A different kind of oven, a different kind of recipe for making barbecue, a different kind of exercise regime, a different kind of phone, a different kind of retirement. There's lots of ways in society where there's a usual way of doing things, and then people propose alternatives, and we're often willing to consider the alternatives. And some people are even especially willing, and you know, they pride themselves on being the first one to try new things.
Yeah.
And then other people's are wait and see. I want to see how it goes for other people. And everybody, I think, all else equal, doesn't want to change. I mean, it's just trouble to change, but still we expect, hey, innovation is going to produce chings over time that will be better than what we have. And eventually we have to be willing to consider switching, right?
Sure.
That's our general attitude toward change in most of society. So we have to notice that in these areas, we have a different attitude. There's a different thing going on here. Yes, there's a reluctance to change, but usually that's not such a big obstacle. Here, it's a much bigger obstacle. That's the thing to think about.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I wanted to also ask you something about I have very little knowledge of economics, but the question that has always sort of seemed like fundamental in this domain is like, okay, like why do recessions happen at all? Like, is this inevitable? And read some like weird book on like currency and credit, and it seemed like maybe credit cycles have some impact on you know, business cycles, etc. But is this am I wrong for saying that recessions, you know, the idea of like, okay, people always, there's always some people who want to work, there's always some work that needs to be done. Like, why should there ever be a situation where there are people who want to work and there's work to be done, but these can't fit together?
Well, when you hire someone, there's a lot of costs involved.
Yeah.
So, first of all, you have to search to find them to see if they are good for your job. And then you have to like take a chance on them. And often they aren't so good, and you have to undo that. And sometimes once you get someone on the job and they're okay, you're going to be pretty reluctant to get them off of it again. And a lot of times, you know, what the initial salary that you take them in at, they can kind of keep them at that for a while. And a lot of these parameters depend on where you are in the business cycle. So, yes. Like a firm at a downturn of the business cycle, it might be hurting for cash. And then they're trying to say, how can we cut back? Because we're kind of running out of money here. And one way to run out cut is to maybe fire a few people, or certainly not hire some people. So the whole economy as a whole is coordinating on a whole bunch of parameters on expectations about how the whole economy is going to do in the near future.
Yeah.
And sometimes they misjudge in one direction, and sometimes they misjudge in the other direction. And so the standard theories of the business cycle are about what happens when there's a misjudgment. You know, the economy does less well than we expected or better. And then everybody has to adjust in the expectation that other people are also adjusting. And those other adjustments will affect your options. And certainly one of the problems is that in a downturn, I don't have as much revenue. I might want to borrow more to make up for that, but everybody else also wants to borrow. And so their interest rates went up. And so I, you know, there's just not so much available. And then a lot of businesses go bust in the downturn, and the people who are lending money to me, they're not sure if I'm one of those. I know better than them, but I can't tell them. And
yes.
So I suffer the fact that they're worried that I might be one of these businesses that goes bust in the downturn. And these create, you know, the dynamics of the business cycle. Now, there's certainly a sense in which any one person has an incentive to overcome these things. Like, clearly, if you could figure out a way to keep your business steady and growing, and you know, more immune to the business cycle, your business would do better. So, in some sense, maybe we block people from following all possible ways they could respond to the business cycle. Maybe we don't let them fire people, for example, or we don't let them use some kinds of financing. But even if we gave them all the tools possible, there's still going to be an effect where sometimes the economy does better than expected, and sometimes it does worse than expected. And then we all have to adjust our reactions to it together in a way that is going to create something like a business cycle.
Yes, I can understand that. And I can understand things like, okay, you know, during the holiday season, you know, maybe e-commerce is expected to do a little bit better. And, you know, that's, you know, an upturn in a cycle or whatever. And sometimes it's not going to be as active. I can understand things like that. But the idea of people saying of this panic, is it purely just irrational? Like, oh, people are freaking out. And this is, you know, a herd of people stampeding for the exits. And this is something that, you know, maybe if we could coordinate better, we would prevent. Or are people rational to expect that, oh, you know, like, I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't seem to address like the fundamental problem of like, why should there be a downturn that people have real panic over? And not just like, oh, things didn't go quite as well as we expected.
Well, why should the downs be as far down, you mean?
I guess so, yeah.
Well, there's a sense in which people care a lot about how deep the downs are. That is, there's data and models in financial markets where a lot of variation in price is all about what's the chance of a really deep downturn,
yeah,
and when. And so that is when things, so the peak of things going up matters, but nowhere near as much as the depth of things going down. You're much more risk averse about, yeah, things going down than going up. And right. So people are really worried about how far down things could go. And certainly when some parts of the economy going down cause other parts to go down, there are these ways the economy reinforces. That's, of course, that's part of the, you know, idea of Federal Reserve, et cetera, trying to manage the business cycle, trying to prevent the downturn part. But so a standard story is that the government should step in and spend more in the downtide and spend less on the upside,
yeah,
as a way to respond, to compensate for the fact that private people are cutting back in the downturn because they're running out of money, their debts are being called in, et cetera. The government maybe not so constrained like that, so it should spend more in the downturn.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is when the government spends as much as it can on the upside, there's not much room for spending more on the downside. And often, right, the government just wants to spend as much as it can, and so it just keeps doing that, right? And so the government isn't able to spend as much on the downside because it blew its wad on the upside. So, for example, one standard thing is the government should spend more than it takes in on the downside. It should borrow on the downside and then unborrow on the upside. It should be spending less than it takes in on the upside to save up enough money to spend more on the downside. But we've had a long period of upside where we've still been borrowing. And so we're kind of running out of room to borrow more on the downside when we've, yeah, borrowed as much as we can on the upside.
That's on. So we're almost at an hour here, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I do want to ask this about the sort of the borrowing and the national debt, because in places like, I was just recently in Argentina, and they have this crazy inflation problem. And, you know, a lot of people blame it on spending too much money, et cetera. It feels like the U.S. is in a slightly different position because we are the world's reserve currency. We are kind of too big to fail. On the question, you're shaking your head. No.
Well, I mean, you can always spend too much. It's always, yeah, possible. There's no, right, you know, unlimited check that you can spend.
Right.
The more we borrow, the more we are at risk for future problems.
Do we not have a lot more wiggle room than other countries, I mean, relative to our GDP?
What happens is that if we inflate like we did recently, then we're basically cheating the borrowers out of what they expected to get paid.
Yeah.
And now they're shy. We go back and try to borrow more from them, and they want a higher price now because,
right,
they got burned last time. And that's always been the main discipline. You know, governments don't want to, you know, renege on the debt because then they'll face much larger borrowing costs in the future.
Yeah.
And that's one of the key disciplines. So we face that discipline. Now, the fact that we control our own currency is different from, say, a country like Argentina, where some of their debt isn't denominated in their own currency, in which case they can't inflate out of it. They'll just have to default, but they, yeah, could default. But again, a similar thing. If you default on the debt, again, borrowers the next time around are going to be more suspicious and demand higher rates.
Right. But I guess, is there any way of like knowing or measuring in advance, okay, like what exactly is an unwieldy amount of debt for the United States?
There are certainly literatures on that, but the problem in our democracy is convincing voters of those numbers.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you had a bunch of studies that gave a distribution of numbers, there's a number in the middle, but you could publish that in an article. But if they want to spend more and they look at your article, they might go, eh, we don't believe you. They just want to spend more. Right.
Right. So I suppose do you sort of laugh at like the modern monetary theory that's like, oh, we can just keep printing and things like that?
Well, sure, but I'm just with all the rest of the economists laughing at that. But
fair.
But you can see the appeal.
Yes.
So honestly, like most of the politics of debt is usually around the idea that we should forgive the debt.
Yeah.
But somehow not charge them more next time. I mean, so if you look at like World Bank loans to the third world countries and what the literature, they're all saying like, hey, just forgive them the debt.
Yeah.
And then, but now, of course, if you forgive them by like not having them repay or somebody pay on their behalf, now the next time we try to loan out, the rates will be a lot higher and people will try to say, oh no, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
So there's a basic disconnect. Fundamentally, if you let people borrow, then you're subsidizing their borrowing or they have to pay back. And the more that they don't pay back through inflation or default, then the more the people loaning the money will just have to ask for higher rates to compensate for that happening more. There's right. Really no way around that. Often people want to use debt as a way to hide subsidies. So they want to say, we're just loaning money to these countries. And that's just a reasonable thing to do. And then later on, they want to say, oh, we should forgive them their loans and turn it into a grant. But they don't want to admit up front that's what they plan to do all along.
Yeah.
Because this is a common thing in politics, is you want to, like we said with NASA, pretend your budgets are low. And then, oh my goodness, be surprised the budgets are high later.
Yeah.
And prediction markets could reveal that. They could do that even for World Bank loans, but people don't like the idea that there are these prestigious people who run the World Bank and they've got big degrees and they look nice in their suits and we want to just trust them.
Yeah. Yeah, we certainly do need some of those prediction markets. That's one thing that I believe very strongly. You've convinced me on that.
But what we need first is the skepticism, the distrust that would make you want them.
Right.
That's the more fundamental thing we lack. People claim to be cynical, but they're not.
Right.
They're actually really pretty trusting of doctors and lawyers and their government and all sorts of people around them. And that's actually the fundamental cause, is that because they're so trusting, well, they get taken advantage of and then they complain, what can we do? And I say, well, if you weren't so trusting, you could use this other thing, and they want to trust.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wild. Robin Hanson, I could talk to you all day. We've been at an hour here. Love talking to you. Can I ask before we go, do you have like a reading list anywhere of just books that you think people would get a kick out of?
No, honestly, I don't read books that often. I read a lot of articles and other things. Books are only one of many sources of things you could learn. And I think many
are you anti-book?
Don't realize that. Not anti-book, but just put in its place. It's a one of a range of sources.
Fair enough.
And honestly, I have a blog post a long time ago called Chase Your Reading. I say, don't just read something because it's there and, hey, maybe you should read it. Have a thing you're trying to learn and then go find things to read to learn about that thing.
Sure.
That's much more productive. You will pay attention to what you're reading. You'll stop reading when it doesn't help. You will remember it because you'll integrate it into your structure. Pick a thing you're trying to learn, trying to figure out, a question in your mind, and then read for the purpose of answering that question.
I think that's a good approach. Robin Hanson, do you have a list of articles that you think people should read?
No, there are just so many on so many different topics. You could pick a topic and I might have something, but no.
Okay. Robin, thank you very much for your time. Anything besides your Substack that you want to plug before we go here?
I do have two books, The Age of M, Work, Love, and Life, and Robots Rule the Earth, and The Elephant in the Brain, Hidden Motives in Everyday Life.
There we go. Robin, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, take care.
Thank you to Robin Hansen, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.